As we look at Romans chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, we really need to be asking ourselves, each one of us, how shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? Now, I might dare to say that this question written by Brother Paul is what we call a rhetorical question. That is, rhetorical means it's just a question to pose food for thought, and it's not really looking for an answer. The answer is already immediately there. Just a question that's asked in order to start off on a subject. And so I really believe Brother Paul asked a rhetorical question here when he said, how shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? He's saying this to point to the fact that to even think about this is pretty unbelievable. I mean, it's almost hard to get your arms around to even think about people that are dead to sin to continue living in sin. And it's impossible to imagine a believer thinking like this. So I think that's the reason that he's asked the question. And based on the things that we said this morning about this idea of continuing in sin, I think there's only two things that you can say about people that continue in sinful habits. It's one or the other of these two things. Either that person who continues in sinful habits is just plain old lost, or else they are children of God that are headed for trouble. One of the two. There's no in between. And so, either way, a human being that is caught up in habitual sinning, living a life in which his habits are continually to go down the road of sin, is either just lost, period, or a Christian, a child of God, that's about to get in trouble. Now, let me bring the reality of this question that Paul asked home to each of us here by asking another question. He says, how shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? How are we going to do it? Let me ask you this question, and some of you that are observant about what God does in nature out here will see the analogy right away. Have you ever noticed when a big fat green caterpillar that feeds on your tomato plants, if you have any tomato plants, or some other kind of plant, they like nightshade plants. We used to find them all the time back in the younger years when, as a young teenager, as a young man, we worked in tobacco. They'd be on tobacco plants all the time. These big, fat, green caterpillars, they like nightshade plants. They eat some other stuff too. But have you ever noticed that when that caterpillar forms a cocoon and goes into that resting pupa stage, that he quits eating that green vegetation off the tomato plants? Quits. Why does he quit? He quits because he's changed. And certainly when he comes out as a nice pretty moth, and they, by the way, those big old fat green caterpillars make a beautiful, nice green, large green, light green, pastel green moth. And if I remember right, those particular caterpillars produce a moth that has what looks like a set of eyes in the middle of each wing. And so when they make that moth, they certainly don't eat that green vegetation like that anymore. Same reason that the pupa doesn't. They metamorphose into something quite different. Now let me ask the question again. How shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? Two things about that before I go on. One, it's talking about living in those, in that state, okay? This is not some kind of a sermon by Brother Paul or me to convince people that they stop sinning when they get saved. It's not that at all. There's a lot of difference between living in habitual sinning and falling into trespass occasionally, or even every day, by virtue of carelessness or whatever. There's a great difference between the two. This is talking about having habits that are sinful in nature, and continuing to entertain those habits and practice them day in and day out, making no effort to resist, making no effort to change. These people who are like that have not passed from the caterpillar stage to the pupil stage yet, nor from the pupil stage to the moth stage yet. They are unchanged and lost. But the caterpillar quits eating the green stuff when he changes to the pupa and changes to the moth, because the life form is changed. So likewise, we, when we're born again by the Spirit of God, there is a change. And in that change, we have the capacity to feed on different things. We have the capacity to quit eating the green vegetation and move to greater things. That's the whole deal. And that's why Brother Paul, I believe, can ask the question, how shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? Now, believers then are alienated from sin by the new birth. They still have sin that clings to them, and sin still happen in their lives. But they're made aliens to sin, and sin is made an alien to them. Sin is your enemy. It is my enemy. And so therefore, it's alien to you. Sin is seen by God's people as not a friend. I hope you see it that way. It's one of the good indicators that you do know Christ as your Savior. Not a friend, not a companion, not a bosom buddy, not something that can supply nourishment to you, and it's not something that you need. That's the way we, as God's people, should be seeing sin. And because that's the way it is with a born-again child of God, Paul goes on to charge believers with the responsibility. And that's where we pick up with verse 12. Down to verse 12. Because of all we've said to this point, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that ye should obey it in the lust thereof. Now, in this command, we see a few things. First of all, you look right at the start of that statement. He engages the child of God to do something about sin in his life. Let not. Do you see, brothers and sisters, that based on this verse of Scripture, we as God's people have a responsibility to God about handling the deal with sin that would usurp authority in our lives? Do you see that God has given over to you a certain responsibility? He wouldn't have given you that responsibility if He hadn't given you the tools to take on that responsibility with Him, do something about it. Let not, he says, and along with the let not, you have the Spirit of God, you have the light in your heart on how to act out that let not. Let not is an indicator from God that there's a personal responsibility to do what God would have us to do about sin in our lives. How many times have you heard preachers quote the apostle from Romans 14 and verse 12, where that he says, every one of us shall give account of himself unto God? Where do you suppose that statement ever came from? Can you see in that statement what I'm talking about? Every one of us shall give account of himself unto God. It's as though in that verse God says, you are responsible. And because you're responsible, I'm going to be asking you to give account to me of yourself, not your husband, not your wife, not your kids, nobody but you. Every one of us shall give account of himself unto God. Both this verse that we're looking at in verse 12 and that from Romans 14 implies a responsibility that we have toward God about managing sin in our lives, about dealing with it. Now, he directs us. Not only does he point us to the fact that we're responsible, But he directs us toward what to not let happen. Let not sin reign in your mortal bodies. He tells me from that if I'm going to get sin out of my life, it's going to be me actively taking part in that process that does it, isn't it? I'm not going to just sit down somewhere and say, well, God, if you want me to quit having this going on in my life, you're going to have to take it away from me. You're going to have to kill it. You're going to have to destroy it. I can't do it by myself, and I don't have any responsibility to do it by myself. You just got to do it for me, or otherwise it won't be done. That's not what he says. He says, don't let sin reign in your mortal bodies. And then he says, in that, he's directing us to take action ourselves. Now, you'll notice, and I want to emphasize this again, lest somebody jump off the deep end and think I'm promoting sinlessness, because it's not going to happen as long as you carry this body around you. But he says, let not sin reign in your mortal bodies. In that very phrase there. Let's just, for the minute, let's realize that means do not let sin rule your body. Be the king that directs what you do with your body. So, and then he points out the threat of sin being such a ruler in our mortal bodies by saying, don't let it reign that you should obey it in the lusts thereof. So don't let sin be the ruler in your life running your body for you. It's your body. And you're made up of a new creature. It's your body. It's not sin's body that can just demand and make dictatorial commands to you. But I want to tell you something, brothers and sisters, and all of you older Christians have learned this. A demanding dictator will be obeyed beyond everything else, and when sin becomes the dictator, it will be obeyed one way or another. That's its aim. That's its objective, and that's the very thing he tells us, you will not allow it to do that. One of the most obvious features of a totalitarian dictator is that they do whatever it is that's necessary to make their slave subjects obedient. Whatever it is, they're going to kowtow them. And believe me, sin operates just that way in your life. It will kowtow you. It will cause you to bow to it if you begin to allow it to reign within your body. Sin, as sin, the ruler that it wants to be, can only rule or reign in a person's body as a dictator. It will never reign as an advisor, okay? It's going to reign as a dictator if it rules at all. Now, looking at verse 13 as we move along, he says, neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin. Here we see something else. Paul identifies other parts of this subjection to sin that we're supposed to avoid. Neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin. Now, sin, being the dictator that it is in a person's body, is going to demand that the person serve the objectives, the agenda of sin. That's what it demands. That's what it's going to have. And sin, in a great sense, acts like a conductor conducting music being played by an orchestra. He knows when to have the violins come in and make their sound. He knows when to have the horns do theirs. He knows when to have each piece of the instrument and each player in that orchestra do his particular part to come out in the forefront. And sin acts that way when it brings itself to be a dictator and attempt to reign in your mortal body. What will happen is that your body will become sin's orchestra. A lot of people imagine that when they allow themselves to be tempted by sin that, well, it's only involving part of me. Maybe I thought some kind of evil thought. Or maybe I just did something evil with my hands or whatever. When sin involves part of your body, it wants to rule over all of it. And it's going to have that rule. if you let it. I think some people think that just one coveted and one protected sin will only affect them in a small way, but sin, whatever it is, a sin seeks to be the dictator ruling the whole body. Now, I really think that people find out in the long run that when they pamper one sin, when they covet to keep one sin close to themselves, they discover in the long term that sin will use the whole body. It will make the whole body involve itself in the sin. Now, you know, it looks like when you go to your tap and you run a glass of cold water and you turn it up and drink it, it looks like somebody's standing back looking on. That drinking of that water only involves your mouth, your lips, your tongue, and your intestinal tract. Now, after that, it involves nothing else. But that's wrong. Because when it gets inside your body, spreads out through all your organs, spreads out through all your cells, the entire body is affected by drinking that glass of water. And that's exactly the way sin is. When we take it up, when we invite it into our lives, it is going to rule the whole body. That's just the way it works. You know, when a disease spreads, like a disease virus, when it gets started, it starts out in like one cell of your body. But as that virus goes to work upon you, it's not long till it has affected every cell in your body. Because that's the way it works. And that's exactly the way sin works. When you go back to that orchestra illustration that I mentioned a few minutes ago, when sin begins its work, the mind sets the tempo. It's almost like the hand of the conductor. And then each part of the body that's to be engaged in producing the final product plays its part in making the music of sin. And that's the way it works in the life of a child of God. Therefore, neither yield your members instruments of unrighteousness unto sin. Don't be some fiddle or some horn or some trombone or something in an orchestra playing for the dictator called sin. And don't let any element, any appendage, any part of your body do that either. The body is a wonderful, wonderful creation made by the Lord, created man in His own image. But it can either produce that which is divine in output, or it can produce that which is devilish in origin. And as long as we remember that, brothers and sisters, we're on pretty solid and safe ground. It can reproduce either evil or good. But we find that there's something it can't do. And that is, it can't function to produce either one of these things, can't function to go in either of these directions without your permission. And so you yield yourself to as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin, or you yield to something else. But it has to do it. It cannot function. It cannot go forward without your permission. And verse 13 shows both sides of this situation. Neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin, but yield yourselves unto God as those that are alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. Now, in this contrast we see here in verse 13, he calls upon the higher person in each one of us. You are those that are alive from the dead, he says. Isn't that an exalted kind of statement from the Word of God? Yield yourselves to God like those that really are alive from the dead. And he challenges us to orchestrate something else, something more exalted, something more glorious than the dead works that He's just been warning us about. Because He says, yield your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. You have the choice. You can do one or you can do the other. You have the power from God to resist the devil and he will flee from you. You have the power from God to hold your body in check. It cannot do anything toward orchestrating sin unless you invite it to as the whole person that you are. And that's the point that we see here. Now in verse 14, Paul states a law of grace that I want to close us with. This is a law of grace. It's not an if or a maybe or a would you consider. This is a law. And this is the part that fits so importantly with what I warned us about this morning, about what God will do when one of His children will continue to sin, habitually practice it, knowing it's wrong, and not seek some way of being cleansed and getting free from it. Notice what he says in verse 14. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for ye are under, not under the law, but under grace. This is a law of grace. It's a law that the Lord has set Himself, and it applies to every one of His people. Sin shall not have dominion over you. Now, if there is a king over us, brothers and sisters, may we everyone say, that king will be King Jesus. That king, that dictator, will not be sin. Now, as I said, we looked at Hebrews 10 earlier this morning, and we pointed out how God deals with those who do not seek to avoid letting sin have dominion over them, letting sin reign in their lives. And when God's people refuse, God will step in and do something. He really will. And probably every one of us have experienced a little bit of that in our lives. I know I have. Maybe you have too. But we need to be reminded that we are bought with a price and we are not our own. And we have the power of choice about rooting sin out of our lives and about dealing with sin that we all wrestle with and have problems with. And these writings of Brother Paul in the 6th chapter of Romans gives us a good set of guidelines for how to deal with sin in our lives, how to avoid becoming victims to the wish and the will of sin to dominate, to be a dictator to our bodies and to lead it about by the nose, if you will, and how we may be strengthened to be rid of that tendency to purge out those sins out of our lives, to do the things that bring the flesh under subjection and give it the strength to resist what's a normal human temptation that may be going on in us because of sin. All right, we trust the Lord has blessed you with this. We trust that He'll strengthen you to know the will of the Lord for your life. We all need to know more about the Lord's will, and we need to strength of faith to be obedient to what His will is for our lives. And may God help each one of us to do that.